Ready to connect with the investment community here in Cleveland? Want to learn about the people, events, projects, and firms that are making a difference? Want all that but feel like you don't have the time? This is the show for you. Welcome to Guardians of Finance. Brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland and hosted by Matt McLaughlin, portfolio specialist at Diamond Hill Capital Management, Guardians of Finance will provide you with a chance to foster deeper connections and know what is getting the attention of Cleveland's investment community. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head to guardiansoffinance.com where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland and attend an educational or social event and find volunteer opportunities. And now, here's your host, Matt McLaughlin.
Welcome to the Guardians of Finance podcast. I am your host, Matt McLaughlin. In this episode, we talk with Matt Rodak, CEO and founder of Upright. Upright, formerly Fund That Flip, is a technology platform used to invest in and obtain loans for renovating residential real estate. Matt was born and raised in Northeast Ohio, and it's where he discovered his passion for real estate investing. Despite living somewhere else now, we talk about his still strong connection to Cleveland, leaving the corporate world on a path to start his own business, and why sleep is classified as a hobby. Thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy this episode with Matt Rodak. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be talking to another Matt, as always.
The more Matts on the podcast, the better, I think. Just personal opinion. Maybe just to start off, introduce yourself and introduce your company and what your company does, and just give us the elevator background for you and the company that you founded.
Appreciate you having me. My name is Matt Rodak, Northeast Ohio native, now living in Washington, D.C. via New York City and Providence, Rhode Island before that. So I've made my way down the East Coast, I guess, if you will. But the company that I started back in 2014 started out as a company called Fund That Flip, and we recently rebranded to Upright. Still do a lot of the same things. And our primary business is providing short-term loans for people that are buying residential properties and fixing them up and bringing them back to market either as for sale properties or oftentimes rental properties. And we also do a fair amount of new construction finance as well, particularly over the past couple of years. We operate, I think, in 35 different states now on the origination side. Somewhat unique thing about our business, which I'm sure we'll get a little bit more into, is we've created an online platform that allows individual accredited investors to invest in relatively small amounts of dollars, relatively speaking anyways, our minimum investments. And one of our core products is $5,000. So you can build your own portfolio of these asset-backed, short-duration, high-yield investment products in a pretty seamless and transparent fashion. So really kind of two sides of our business. On one side, we're out looking for good operators and helping them capitalize their business. And on the other side, we're bringing what we think is a very interesting yield product, if you will, to a group of investors that otherwise may not have access to this type of product.
This podcast focuses on connections to Cleveland and whatnot within the investment community in Cleveland. I know you guys have an office here in Cleveland, but maybe just talk a little about your connection to Cleveland, where you're born, raised, and how often you get back and that sort of thing, if that's all right.
So I was born and raised in Louisville, Ohio, spelled like Louisville, Kentucky, which is a small town just, what is it, east of Canton. So I usually say I'm from Canton, Ohio. Grew up there, and maybe this gets a little bit into my founding story a little bit, but had a landscaping business and ended up doing a lot of work for house flippers and saw that as an interesting career choice and gave me the idea to want to study finance and hopefully get into some type of real estate development. So I ended up at John Carroll on the east side of Cleveland, studied finance there, played 4 years of college football there, lived in downtown Cleveland for I think three-ish years post-graduation. Was commuting from Cleveland out to one of the suburbs for my job. And I've always had this dream, if you will, from early days of having a business and an office in Cleveland. And now we have about 17,000 square feet in the AECOM building right on East 9th. And probably 60 to 70% of our 100-person staff is based in the Cleveland office. So currently live in Washington, D.C., but back and forth to Cleveland just about every other week.
I did not know that I was talking to another former washed up meathead Division III football player. So good to connect there. So what position did you play at John Carroll?
I was a defensive back. So I think I did my first 2 years as a cornerback and then moved back into safety junior and senior year. It was a lot of fun. I think I got the most enjoyment of the time in between the games on Saturdays in the locker room and practice. It's just a different type of fraternity, I would say, in Division III anyway. So it was a lot of fun.
Totally agree with that. I joke with people like I got a degree in marketing, finance, and football. And so we put in a lot of time with those people and it's fun. So that's great to hear. You mentioned when you had your landscaping business, that's when you got introduced to real estate investing and finance and made you go to school for finance. What were some of those early memories as far as what intrigued you about finance and put you on that path? Maybe an experience or two or just something that you gravitated towards. What made you go down that path?
I had a small landscaping business and one of my commercial clients was a mortgage broker, and a lot of the LOs, loan officers, were doing investing in residential real estate back in, this would have been probably like 2001, 2002. So they'd see me cutting the grass out in front of their place of work and come out and say, "Hey, I just bought this new property over on wherever. Can you go over there and clean up the yard?" And it gave me just this exposure to seeing this property transform from often cases really distressed, ugly, bring down other property values type homes. And over the course of 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months, as I was going back every week to continue to cut the grass and whatnot, see the property transform. We were also high school kids, cheap labor. So we'd oftentimes get involved in the demoing and the cleaning out. And we had trucks and trailers and all that good stuff. So occasionally we'd get a look at the inside of the properties, you know, before and after. And just generally thought it was a pretty cool thing of what they were doing for the local neighborhoods and communities they were operating in. And seeing these properties come back to life was also just intriguing to me. My grandfather was a carpenter and would fiddle with him out in his shop and build things. So like this idea of working with my hands, but also saw the numbers aspect of it, the money aspect of it. So I just was generally intrigued by the confluence, if you will, of business and working with your hands. These guys were also not shy to tell me how much money they would make, you know, on one of these house flips. So as a 16-year-old living in Canton, Ohio, and hearing someone just made 30 or 40 or 50 grand per project also perked my ears up. So yeah, I think it was just something that it's a physical thing you can put your hands on, but also seemed to be a pretty cool way to make a living. So that was my goal, go study finance and get into some type of real estate development career. I knew I probably wasn't ready to go right out on my own. So I wanted to find a job where I could learn some skills and have some tangential experience to set me up well for eventually doing that on my own. Didn't exactly go as I planned, but got there one way or another. So I graduated Carroll in 07, right when the housing market was starting to do its capitulation, if you will, and weren't a ton of opportunities in the real estate development world circa 2007, 2008. So found a different path there, but happy how I got here in the long run, I guess.
I'm curious, you had the on the ground examples from your upbringing, those experiences you just talked about. And then you go to John Carroll and you had, okay, here's what a discounted cash flow is and all those metrics we all learn about. At what point, if there was one, do you remember those worlds meshing, understanding the financial side of it, other than just, oh, I buy it at low, sell it at high and make this amount of absolute dollars? Like, do you remember when those worlds meshed? I'm just a little curious there.
Certainly, I think having some of that when we're doing NPV and just cash flow, I had a reference point. I think the biggest eye-opening thing for me was actually in my, I think, entry-level accounting class. And the first day of class, you write down something unique about yourself. And I always put the Matt's landscaping thing. So for whatever reason, that professor decided to use me as his use case for the whole class on like, what is a balance sheet and a P&L statement and all those different things. And I remember a light bulb going off in that class of like, oh, I have accounts receivables. But like, I didn't call it that. I just had this person owes me this amount of money and I'm going to send them an invoice and they're going to pay me and it's going to turn to cash and I'm going to close the invoice out. So I would say it was probably more applicable for me with my landscaping business of how I was managing my P&L that I didn't know was a P&L and a balance sheet that I didn't know was a balance sheet and some of these other things. And realizing there's terms for these things was like super eye-opening for me. So I think probably less on the real estate side, but more on the Matt's landscaping side. It made it super easy for me to connect some of these things that you learn about in the books to like, oh, here's how I'm actually using this. Or I could see this being used on a larger scale in a much larger business, obviously, than my landscaping business.
Take us through your early career. You mentioned graduated around 2008. So real estate, not the greatest place to want to look for work at the time, I'm sure. Where'd you start off early in your career and how did that get navigated back towards real estate, what you eventually wanted to do?
Yeah, so I'd say my first real job out of college was with a large commercial property insurance and risk management company. I cut my teeth there as what was called a production underwriter. So the example that I'll use in Cleveland is we insured the Cleveland Browns Stadium. So it was like very large commercial properties and other types of manufacturers. So got some really good exposure to thinking about risk and pricing risk and managing risk. Was in that role for a number of years. And I was also the young, ambitious kid, I guess, out of college that had a lot of ideas. Part of my job was also sales. So it was one part risk and one part sales. And I was always the kid that said like, hey, our website could be better. Our marketing materials could be better. Our CRM, we don't really have one. I guess I was loud enough with some of these ideas that eventually they asked me to move from Cleveland out to Rhode Island where they were headquartered and spearhead some of these initiatives around, call it our sales and marketing initiatives for the middle market division of this much larger company that I was working for. So I had a really fantastic opportunity to work underneath the team that had grown that business from like an $80 million business to like an $800 million business over a 10-year period, and got exposure to how to build technology and CRM systems and new websites and translate them and localize them into, I think, 7 or 8 different languages, and build training programs on how to effectively position and go to market with the different products that we had. And also got to travel around the world, which was cool. So I like to say that was kind of my mini MBA without being an official MBA, of growing a company inside of a much larger organization and being on the leading edge of some larger strategic initiatives, and where I got some exposure to technology and how that can be a leverage and a force for scaling a company if done right. So a really great experience. I like to say the biggest thing that I learned through that experience is that I for sure didn't want to be an insurance executive for the rest of my life. I saw what that path looked like. And it was around that time that, this is probably 2010, 2011, real estate market was starting to heal a little bit. There's a lot of properties coming out of obviously foreclosure and short sale and different distress situations. So I started to dabble, if you will, in what my initial passion was, which was real estate investing, plugged into the local real estate investor community up in Rhode Island, and would go work for guys for free on the weekends just to learn the ins and outs. And hey, how'd you buy this thing and how are you financing it? And moved into, let's do some partnerships. Let's do some partnership on the next one so I can maybe play a role in it and have some skin in the game. And eventually evolved into starting to think about doing some of my own deals. So yeah, that was the trajectory. And I think through that experience, the biggest thing I learned was that capital obviously is a very important part of this business. So you couldn't walk into Bank of America or Wells Fargo, or and really still can't today, and get a loan on a distressed property that you're not going to live in. It's an investment property. So I started to learn of this financing ecosystem, if you will, that provided the capital for these fix and flip properties, which is called hard money lending or private money lending. And saw an opportunity, I think, in my experience trying to get money for my deals, a way to form capital in a way that I thought would be much more efficient, certainly for the customer, but also potentially creates some interesting opportunities for a broader spectrum of people to invest in this type of product, which I think is very interesting. And unless you know someone that's flipping houses, it's not really an option for, or building homes for that matter, it's not really an option to get exposure to this type of, one of the most interesting risk-adjusted yielding asset classes that exist. So that was the genesis idea. I was borrowing money on one side and just doing some alternative investing in some peer-to-peer unsecured consumer loans on Prosper and Lending Club in the early days, and started to think about, well, what if these two ideas were brought together, right? You bring private money, hard money lending, and you bring it forward from a how you institutionalize that and use data and technology to make that business work well, but also use some of the concepts that these de novo platforms, like I said, Lending Club and Prosper, were playing around with on the unsecured consumer side to fractionalize these loans. And ultimately, that's what Fund That Flip became, and now Upright.
At the time, 2010 or early 2010s there, did you see the opportunity that people were going to make a lot of money doing that? I feel like those 2010s were really good years for people flipping houses. Was it pretty apparent, or was there still just so much uncertainty that you weren't sure if it was going to be a big money-making thing, just flipping houses?
In hindsight, you could have bought anything at any price back in 2013 or 12, and if you held onto it, you'd be in pretty good shape today. But yeah, I think the sentiment back then was still very... people were very cautious still about anything that was housing, particularly single family, because of the amount of, I don't know what the right word is, but damage, right, that had just been done to the psyche, I think, of anything around single family house. So the word flip has been a bad word, I think, since 2007 or 2008 in some ways. More from my perspective personally is, like, I've been a part of some of these projects and it turned out I didn't really like it that much. Managing all the different moving parts and picking paint colors and countertops. And like, there's an infinite number of small decisions that have to be made to execute one of these projects well. And at the time I was paying upwards of 18% for the money. And that guy was sitting in his office, not making any of those decisions and clipping close to half of the profit when it was all said and done. So I think from my perspective, it was just a more interesting return profile relative to the risk, if you will, to be in the lender shoes as opposed to the operator shoes. And I was also interested in building a business that could scale, and thinking about operating 20 or 50 or 100 flips is overwhelming just from an operations perspective, whereas originating 100 or 200 or even 1,000 loans felt much more manageable from a scalability perspective. So long-winded answer to your question there, but yeah, I think where we're at today too, the saying I think is you can always make money in real estate. You just got to know what side of the market you're on. We've seen a couple of these different changes in sentiment, but also reality in the single family space over the past decade, particularly.
No, you just led right into what question that was bringing my mind is, why not stay and just keep flipping houses and why start up a company? But maybe what was the catalyst that finally pushed you over the edge that you were going to leave that corporate job and start your own thing?
There were a couple. The first was the idea. I think this is one of the mistakes I think a lot of early stage entrepreneurs make is they don't want to tell anybody about their idea because they think it's so great and they don't want anybody to steal it. And I was the opposite. And I think someone had told me this, like, no one's going to steal your idea. And it's all about execution anyways. I was on a mission to try to get someone to tell me it was a dumb idea and it wouldn't work. And I just kept getting from potential customers and investors, hey, this makes sense. So gave me enough confidence to run it down. Eventually moved down to New York City, thinking that'd probably be a better place to start a fintech business than Providence, Rhode Island, and got involved in a early stage incubation program there that I think helped me build out some additional confidence in the plan was. And eventually I got to the point where like someone was like, yeah, I'd like to do a deal with you and borrow some money from you. And had enough other people on the other side of the equation said, yeah, if you found a deal that looked like that, I'd give you 25 or 50 grand and we could fund it. So it was about a month before I got married, those pieces came together. And I was like, well, if I'm going to do this and I'm going to take somebody else's money and be a steward of that, and at the same time, lend someone money and be a good partner for them, like I have to be all in on it. So quit my job and when was it? Fall of 2014 to go full time, just as a function of now or never. Let's give it a shot. And if it doesn't work, I know what that other track looks like and I can always go back over there if I need to. So that was it. It was just talking to anybody that would listen about the idea and building enough confidence and conviction in it. And then it became real. And I was like, oh, now that it's real, like I got to go all in on it if I'm going to take someone's money, particularly.
Was that the moment that you're like, oh, wow, this is going to work? Did that moment come later that, yes, okay, you found a couple initial transactions and hey, maybe there's something here. Like, what was the point where it got to such scare? Like, wow, I can do this and I can make decent money doing it. Wow, this is a, I'm not trying to insult it, but like a real business that can scale and that can really go somewhere.
I don't know exactly if there was a particular moment. I think at least in our business, it built, we did one deal and then we did a second deal and then a third deal and a fourth deal. And then we got into another accelerator program in Manhattan. I would say it was a little bit more of another, I think, positive signal that we might be onto something. This accelerator takes 1,000 applications and they take 10 companies. And we were one of those 10 companies. And I was like, well, these guys must know something about what a good business can look like. So there were little moments like that, I think, along the way. And I remember we got into that program and we had done, I think, a total of 4 loans. And John, one of the managing partners over there, is like, we got to figure out how to get you from 4 to 40. And like, I was like, what? 40 loans? Like, that seems like incredible. And now we do 200 or 300 a month. I think it's just all incremental in terms of how you build up to that. And there's different milestones along the way. You raise some venture capital money, again, from more smart people that have perspectives on these types of things. And your horizon on what's the next set of milestones that we need to get to continue to believe in what we're doing, I think just continues to extend out, if you will, the further along you get.
Was technology always a big part of your kind of long-term plan to scale? I mean, I'm sure those first couple loans, you hadn't built out the technology platform and whatnot yet. At what point did technology really come into play, maybe from a plan perspective and from an implementation perspective, that this is all going to be done on a technology-savvy platform?
I think it's always been part of the thesis. And I think part of that thesis was informed by this borrowing money from this guy in Rhode Island, and he doesn't have a website. He doesn't even really like email. He's got paper application forms and he's making money and making this business work. So like, how much more efficient could just his business be by having an online form to take in an application and some basic decisioning technology to help programmatically do the underwrites and different things like that? So I wouldn't say, you know, we've ever really necessarily sought out to be a pure play technology company as much as like a technology enabled company to say, hey, we provide a financial service to 2 different types of customers. And there's certainly a role for technology to play in enabling that and making that more efficient and more transparent and just an overall better experience for the customer. But also appreciating the fact that it is still very much a human business when you're taking investor dollars and or deploying capital or partnering with someone, that the way they make money is investing in real estate and they want a handshake and a phone call occasionally here and there. So I think we've done a pretty good job of finding the right mix between what things should be technology solved versus what things should need to be still customer service and people focused, but will continue to be a big part of our strategy as we continue to think about what comes next.
You're in Washington, D.C. right now. You guys have an office in Cleveland. At what point did it move out of New York City and maybe there's still an office there to those locations that you're at now?
I think a big impetus for us and a lot of people was COVID. So we had a high percentage of our population in our New York office and our Cleveland office kind of pre-COVID. We opened our Cleveland office, I think, in 2017. So 1 or 2 years into our start. I remember, this is drawing it back, I think, to the Cleveland connection. I remember flying back to Cleveland, forget if it was Thanksgiving or Christmas. And remember thinking, I think I was still in Providence. I remember thinking like, it'd be really cool to start this company in Cleveland or like have a presence in Cleveland. Give me a good reason to come home and open up that office downtown that I always wanted to. So it just so happened that one of our first hires as we got started in 2015 and then into 16, he started within 16, was a guy that I met from a guy that I met at the Cleveland Browns bar in New York. Going to watch a Browns game, got introduced to this guy. He's from North Canton. A year later, he's like, hey, you should meet my buddy. He's worked for these different companies. It's applicable. And I know what you're starting and you guys should talk. So he drove out to New York, told him what we were doing. He's like, that sounds cool. Like, if you want to hire somebody, I'm in. We hired him. He was working from home in Hudson. And then what he was doing was working. And it was like, all right, we need to hire some more people to support this person. He's in Cleveland. Why don't we just hire people in Cleveland? We started to grow our Cleveland presence pretty early on for a lot of different reasons, but COVID happened right as we were moving into our new office space. We started to expand our aperture in terms of where we were hiring people at a pretty fast growth period for the company. So we ended up with people all over the country. And at that time, it was for me and my wife, time to move down to DC. That's where her family's from. And her career is works down here. So we moved to DC when we were still pretty much a complete remote workforce. But obviously over the past couple of years, we've started to migrate back to the office, but we're still 40% remote. So Cleveland's our only physical presence at this point. New York is closed. 60-70% of our people, like I said, are in Cleveland. The rest of us are scattered across the globe.
I don't know if there's a distinct answer to this, but are you a work from home with a flexibility? Are you an office person or maybe somewhere in between? There's probably a spectrum now. Where do you lie in that spectrum and where do you see the puts and takes with the benefits of being in an office or the benefits from working from home?
I personally love being in the office. If I could be in our Cleveland office every day, I think I would be. I also really appreciate the fact that I walk down or up one flight of stairs and at my desk and going, and we've got two young kids now. So 5:30, I shut it down and I'm there with them immediately. So I really do get both sides of the equation, if you will. I think there's a particular benefit for being in person around big strategic conversations or tough conversations, or if you've got a new employee that needs to be trained up, and the best way to learn is through osmosis and right, just in the moment type learning opportunity. So we haven't mandated anyone come back to work. We encourage people to try to get in, particularly if they're local to Cleveland, in a couple of days a week, particularly around big meetings and things where in person provides a benefit. But it's hard to say where it goes. I think definitely doesn't go back to 5 days in the office anytime soon, if ever. But look at us. We're talking over a Zoom call right now, and it feels normal. It wasn't a normal thing 4 years ago.
Totally. And I would second your comments about walking out of your office and going, and I have two young kids as well. And the benefits of that, I work for a company that's in Columbus, actually. But it's nice to go into the office every once in a while, too. So I can totally appreciate that.
I think it's a lot of things. Finding the right balance. Don't eat too much sugar. Don't drink too much alcohol. You know, it's like anything else. Just find whatever the right balance is. There's downsides of being in the office, too. Like if you've got deep focus work that you need to do and you've got an open office policy, like you're getting peppered with questions all day. I think where we've landed, at least for our company, is pretty healthy for the moment.
What about the Cleveland market and opening a business or an office there? What about it that you think would surprise someone who's maybe not from Cleveland about the benefits or unique to Cleveland that would surprise the average business owner that maybe grew up on the East Coast or grew up somewhere else in the Midwest that, wow, Cleveland's really good at this, or the benefits of opening an office or a business in Cleveland is this? What would you say to that?
I guess I got to give a shout out to my alma mater, John Carroll University. I think we've got like, I don't know how many now, 25 or 30 JCU alums in the company. So we've had a lot of success in hiring as first jobs out of school or second or maybe even third jobs from the alumni network. But I think taking a broader look at it, our initial decision point was proximity to the person they're primarily going to be working with. But it was also, we were paying, I think, $800 or $900 a month for a desk in WeWork in Manhattan. And that was like the same cost for an entire 2,500 square foot office space in Cleveland. So I think there's a bang for your buck equation that the Midwest generally is tough to beat. I think the other great thing is you've got as many smart people, I'm convinced, in Cleveland as you do in New York, and they have less outlets for the type of work that a startup or a a more innovative company like ours offers them in terms of growth opportunities and experience and even wear jeans and a hoodie to work type culture. So I think we have somewhat of an unfair competitive advantage on competing for talent as a function of we're just different. We're different than what a lot of the more traditional types of companies exist in a market like Cleveland. Not to disparage any of them, but it's just we're somewhat of an outlier in terms of what we offer from a career and culture perspective. And I think that has been a huge advantage, both in terms of attraction, but also retention for some great people.
You've lived in multiple places, Cleveland, Providence, Rhode Island, New York, now DC. Go through each of those places. And what's your favorite part about that place that is kind of unique to each one of those? Because I think they're three very different cities. I'd love to hear your perspective just from a quality of life or enjoyment or whatever it may be, the unique aspect of each one of those places.
My experience post-college in Cleveland was really the last time I lived there was great because I still had a fair amount of friends from school living locally, but also got involved in the Cleveland Professional 2030 Club, which expanded my network pretty quickly and broadly. And I think the nice thing about Cleveland is even people from there are willing to make friends with people that aren't from there. And there's a lot of people that aren't from Cleveland that are also looking to, I think yourself included, become part of the community. So I thought that would be the case for a lot of other places I moved to. And Providence was a very beautiful town in my first experience living on the East Coast. So getting down to Newport and up to the mountains in the winter and different things like that was really cool. It's got very much of like, well, you're not from here. So it was challenging. I think I was like, oh, they got to have a 2030 club like Cleveland did. I'll just plug in there and run the same play that I ran post-graduation. That didn't exist. We started one, right? Try to get some of that going. But and then New York is just New York. It's on all the time and you're amped up. And I think it does raise your level of both awareness as well as performance, just in terms of the bar that is set there for the type of talent energy that's in the city, which was a great place to be, particularly when we were starting the company. DC, I think, is a pretty good hybrid of, I would say, all three of those. I think a little bit more friendly. No one's really from DC. So it's almost all transplants looking to make new connections and meet, but still has a lot of, I think, what we liked about New York, which is got all the museums and the restaurants, and you're a couple hours to the beach east and a couple hours to the mountains to the west. So it's been good. I still have three or four, or maybe five of my good friends from college all live in Shaker Heights within a mile of each other. So super jealous when I'm back visiting them because I'm like, you guys get to hang out all the time. But other than that, DC is good.
On a personal front, what are some of your personal passions that you enjoy when that you close the office door at 5:30 and go downstairs? What do you enjoy doing?
Yeah, I alluded to it earlier. I have a 2.5-year-old and a 6-month-old. So most of my non-work time is spent playing with and caring for two young boys, which has been a ton of fun. I generally still like real estate. So like I look at real estate deals. I invest in different types of real estate deals. I do a little bit of early stage venture capital and angel investing. So I like to be around business, I think, and different strategies and different markets and things like that. So maybe I'm a sicko in that regard, where I don't have a lot of hobbies outside of my children and somewhat work-related things.
I probably had a very similar answer. My kids are just a little bit older, but you're in the dark years. You're in the hunker down mode. And so I can totally empathize with that. But as I'm sure other people have told you, it's fun and it just keeps getting funner. So maybe we transition into the part of the podcast that we call the kind of the lightning round or rapid fire questions and just go through a couple of just lighthearted questions, if that's okay with you.
Sounds great.
Do you have a nickname?
I do. So my last name's Rodak. I've been Dak most of my life to anybody that particularly I played sports with. So I don't actually think I acknowledged my first name as Matt being Matt until I got a job at 23 or something. I was just Dak my whole life, or Rodak.
And that's pre-Dak Prescott.
That's right.
So you're the original Dak.
I think my dad was a Dak before either I or my brother were. So it's, it goes way back.
Favorite book about investing or finance? Obviously couldn't be on the real estate side as well.
I recently was given a book by one of my board members called 100 Baggers, and about different companies 100x their stock price, which I find interesting, both just in terms of how those companies did it, but some of the patterns that emerge in there.
Profession you'd be in if you weren't in anything investment, real estate, or finance related? You got to go outside of those. Sounds like you have a pretty good passion for business, so I'm making you go outside of those.
In no way am I suggesting that I'm qualified for this, but I think being a professional golfer would be a lot of fun, just in terms of being outside and traveling and being competitive. I think that'd be a cool career.
Sounds like you've traveled a little bit. So what's your favorite destination you've been, and what's on your bucket list, maybe for when the kids get a little bit older and you can give them to grandma and grandpa and you and the wife can go somewhere?
The two, probably the top of the list, we did a African safari, and then we did Southeast Asia for our honeymoon, Cambodia and Thailand. I think if I had to pick, I think I'd like to go back to Southeast Asia and maybe do like Vietnam for the bucket list one.
What's your favorite food spot in Cleveland?
There's this Vietnamese place, sticking with that theme, close to our office called Bo Teng Cafe. Has very good pho.
I can tell you know it because you pronounce it the right way. Most people, they say, oh, pho. No, that's pho.
Fortunately, living in New York, you get some of that good, authentic, different cultured foods, and Cleveland's got some of the best on the Vietnamese side of things.
What's your favorite way to get active? Do you work out, run, swim, or is it just chasing around a 2.5-year-old, which is a valid answer?
Chasing kids around a lot. I got roped into this Sunday morning run by one of my neighbors recently, where we do 400-yard sprints, 3 200-yard sprints, 2 300-yard sprints, a 400-yard sprint, and then you go back down. So that's about as much activity as I do in a week, but it's plenty intense.
Don't pull a hammy on that. You're not what you used to be, I'm sure. Most memorable Cleveland sports moment.
The one that sticks out to me is I think it was the 2006, 2007 Cavs. They won the Eastern Conference Finals over the Pistons. I think it was my first year downtown Cleveland post school. I think it was also opening weekend for the then Indians, now Guardians. So there's all this sports activity. I remember it seemed to be like a turning point for Cleveland sports that year where they finally beat the Pistons to go to the NBA Finals. I think the Indians made a run that year, and then the Browns was the first year they made the playoffs. So it was like that was a very exciting time to be a Cleveland sports fan.
Are you still an avid Cleveland sports fan, even though you're in DC and you've lived in a couple other places?
They're still definitely my team. That's one of the things I had to give up a little bit starting a company and having kids was how much I watch of sports, but I definitely follow and root for all of them.
That is all the rapid fire questions. I will say that this podcast is going to come out mid-March. And for anyone who is listening that hasn't checked the upcoming event schedule, this is coincidentally with an event that we're having with Matt as a speaker where you dive into more things in real estate and he provides some insights there. So not because we didn't want to dive into them here, but we purposefully steered away from the investment insights and the market and whatnot so that we could save it for that event. So if you're listening to the podcast and want to talk more about that, Matt will be at an event. I think it's April 10th, I believe. I'm forgetting the date off the top of my head. We look forward to having you for lunch at the City Club. And thanks for making the time today to talk with the podcast.
Thanks for having me. Looking forward to chatting more in April.
You've been listening to Guardians of Finance, brought to you by the CFA Society of Cleveland. Subscribe to the podcast on your favorite podcast platform and head on over to guardiansoffinance.com where you can connect or reconnect with the CFA Society of Cleveland, attend an educational or social event, and find volunteer opportunities. Thanks, and we'll see you next time on Guardians of Finance.